Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of the HYM podcast, and it's another change of hosts. We tried to get all three of us, but again, we haven't managed to do it, Jake.
Wow, I'm as consistent as something that's very consistent.
Nick's consistent. Nick's consistent as the British weather, you know.
Yeah, it's also as consistent as the French are in the Euros.
Yes. Not very consistent.
No, this, I don't think we're going to get many French followers from that.
What a game.
Yeah, that was brilliant, to be fair. I don't mean, most people come on here not to listen to better football, but I think there's probably a fair few that are watching the Euros right now.
Yeah, but if you're a sports fan, you know, that's just, you know, mate, a comeback. Comeback kings like that. And it was good to see. But you know, the big game's tonight.
I saw Louis Delatrez, obviously he's Swiss, all over Twitter last night, loving it.
Getting on it.
Yeah, so he was fully involved. But yeah, pretty good night for anyone who's not French.
Yeah, but the big game, as I just said, tonight, England, Germany.
Yeah, big one. Well, I don't know if it's the most famous fixture in international football, but it's up there.
I think me and Jake would say it's the Birmingham versus Aston Villa game of international matches, I think.
Yeah, underrated that Villa versus Blues is.
Yeah. As a Blues fan, me and Jake as a Villa fan, we know what that one's like. But yeah, big game tonight, so we're going to be rooting for England, of course. But I think our guest is going to be watching it with somebody who's definitely going to be rooting for Germany tonight.
Yeah, just chatting to him before, I think he's going to have an interesting watch tonight. So on the episode today, we have Haas F1 reserve driver, an all-round top bloke, Pietro Fittipaldi. But yeah, you're going to be watching, you said to us just now, Pietro, you're going to be watching it with the Haas team, obviously British mechanics and British guys, and probably with Mick. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, man. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast. And tonight we're having a team barbecue. And it's going to start around half an hour before the game. So then throughout the barbecue, we're going to be watching it. And all the team's going to be there. Like, the whole, like, all the mechanics are basically English. And then you have Mick and his trainer, who are German. They're going to be there as well.
Oh, proper so outnumbered they are.
Bro, it's going to be, bro. But I think that game's going to be really good. That game's going to be really good. And yesterday's game was amazing. Like, honestly, when France came back and went 3-1, like, I honestly didn't think that Switzerland was going to have a chance to come back, because it was already late in the game. It was like 70 minutes into the game or something, 65. And I was like, oh, the game's over. Like, and then they scored one goal, and then there was like 9 minutes to go. And I was like, you know, it's not going to happen. And they fucking did it. It's crazy.
No, I mean, when Pogba scored that goal, I mean, they scored like three goals in like 15, 20 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, I was like, it's over. It's like they have too much momentum now. It's impossible for them to come back.
Yeah, and then that one goal goes in, and it's amazing in football just how quickly things change. I think it's a team sport thing maybe as well. Like, you know, you can't win the game on your own, and you get one guy that could be really motivated to keep trying, but the other guys get a little bit like down and disheartened. But then one goal goes in, and everyone believes all of a sudden.
Yeah, and that makes a big difference. Like, they get like the game switched, like it turns the table, and the momentum goes then back to them.
Yeah,
and then they're attacking already a lot. Because once France were scoring those goals, they were like just always on their end of the pitch on Switzerland's end. And they were always attacking. Then as soon as Switzerland scored that, it was like it switched. And then it's like they had all the momentum. So it was crazy.
I couldn't believe it. Because like, I'm in a hotel room here. So I'm like, I'm just on my phone. I was watching a film, and I was like, and Jake texts the group chat and goes, my God, did you see that goal by Pogba? And I was like, no. So I looked at the goal and I was like, geez, that's good. And then I saw, France 3-1 up. Ah, you know, it's over. And then I'm just checking like the BBC Sport app, and it's like 3-2, 3-3. And I'm like, right, get some clothes on downstairs. Downstairs.
You weren't watching it?
No, I wasn't watching it because you can't get anything on those TVs. And I sprinted downstairs, and they had it on in the lobby, you know. And there was like a group of like 20 people going mad at this game. It was great.
Any French people watching it?
I think there was a few. Oh, I think there was a few. But we were all going mad for Switzerland because there are a bunch of Italians here. So
yeah, the underdogs.
The underdogs. So yeah, no, quality game though.
Yeah. So you're out in Austria, obviously, at the moment, Pietro, aren't you? So we just had the Styrian Grand Prix, I guess it was called this time. And what, the Austrian Grand Prix is the next one up, I guess.
Yeah, second week here. So I got here last Wednesday or Thursday. And then, back-to-back races. Similar how it was last year when I was there with you guys in F3 and stuff. So back-to-back, same track layout and everything. Just, they're just changing the compound. So they're going softer this weekend.
Yeah.
All around.
I think there's worse tracks in the world to sort of spend 2 weeks at, I think.
Yeah, because it's pretty beautiful here.
Yeah. We had a great time last year.
Yeah, it was so fun, man. I was sharing a room with Enzo, and then we were all in the same hotel. It was really fun. And that bike ride, when you and Jack went bike riding, me and Enzo tried to keep up with you guys. It was uphill for like a solid hour. That was death on a bike. Yeah. I was dying.
that was altitude as well. That was tough.
Yeah, because you were struggling and you bike like every single day. I hadn't biked in like a year or something.
I normally I bike on a road bike and not on a mountain bike, and it's actually a lot harder on a mountain bike. I didn't expect it as much. No. But we had a great time there, to be fair. And I think, well, we didn't actually have that many decent results last year, did we? With HWA. but we won't talk about that. Well, unfortunately, I guess the results right now in Haas likewise aren't where you would like them to be as a team.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, but it started already a bit, kind of 2019, and then 2020, after COVID and stuff, the team decided to stop the development, and then then the regulation change was supposed to be this year in 21, and then Formula One delayed it to 2022. So the team basically decided we're going to stop the development of this sort of generation or this regulation car and start working on 2022 car. So then, for sure, it's other teams are still developing. And Mercedes said now they're going to stop developing their car for the rest of the season and focus on next year's car. But Haas has been doing that since last year. So it's tough. Then all the Ferrari engines and stuff last year weren't the greatest. It took a big step this year. But in terms of the package we have, it's just a bit, it's not up to par to everybody else's. And the team's just focused on next year's car, basically.
Yeah, I think it makes sense for a team like Haas, doesn't it, really, with the resort of, I know the cost cap's coming, but still, I guess they can't even reach the cost cap in terms of the money they can spend right now. So they're still, I guess, running a disadvantage in that respect compared to at least the top teams. So it makes sense for me, for a team like Haas, to be focusing on a massive set of rule changes next year, where that sort of rules are going to carry on over for like 4 or 5 seasons minimum. And you can have, you can set yourself, and if you start on a good sort of starting point, you're going to have a good sort of car, hopefully, for half a decade at least. Whereas, if you put it all into this year for 1 year, and set yourself on the back foot next year, you're going to have years like this year for almost, another 2 or 3 years after this. So it makes sense, I think.
Yeah, for sure. That's the kind of mindset of the team. And it would be a huge investment to try to bring upgrades to the car, last year and then this year. And then when you think of the new regulations, is that going to play into next year's car? And it's really not, because the car is so drastically different. So, the focus everything on, building a good car for this new sort of generation Formula One car. And with the two rookie drivers in the car now, it's kind of, for them every week and trying to gain experience. I mean, it's crap if you think about it, because it's like you're racing Formula One and you're just here kind of knowing you're going to be, not having the most competitive package, but going into the season knowing that and just trying to gain mileage. But that's the mindset right now. And then, hoping that next year's car is going to be a lot better.
Do you think that gives like a good environment to learn in though? Because this is the pinnacle. This is the top, and you've got to go into it and as a rookie and expected to do well. But if you sort of know that, the focus is next year's car and next year's package, I think I'd quite like that. I think I'd quite like to be going out every weekend and thinking, right, I've just got to better myself.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of agree. I mean, if you're if you're going knowing you already have a contract for next year with the team and you're not really having to, I mean, you still have to do a good job, obviously, trying to execute everything that, you know, that's under your control. But coming in as a first year where the car doesn't, you know, you can't really make that much of a difference because the deficit is so big. And you're just there, you know, trying to gain mileage and, you know, getting better every weekend. And for sure, it's great. Because then if the car is good next year, you know, you've had a whole season where you've been able to really prepare yourself and make sure you're on it when it really counts and you're fighting for points and hopefully podiums and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you go into there and you're coming from F2, let's say, and you know you're going to be in a good car, like, I don't know, trying to think like Lando maybe got in 2019. When he came from F2 straight into a point scoring car, you know, I think we're all kind of guys that would be confident enough. I know I would be confident enough in my own ability to be able to do the job, but knowing that you have to be realistic that you're going to improve, let's say, over the year or 2 or 3 years. And you see that with Lando, even, you know, he had a good first year, but where he is now, he's obviously doing an extremely good job. But if you're at the back and you're not scoring points every week, regardless, I think, you know, there's no reason but it's almost nice not to have that added, you know, pressure, let's say. You know, the team don't need to be scoring points this year. They've made that obviously clear, I guess, to Nikita and to Mick. And, you know, whilst you would like to be, for the guys like them as rookies, it just settles that down, I guess. Settles any kind of rookie nerves down. They can get all the learning out the way, all the silly mistakes out the way that, I guess, they already seem to be improving a little bit compared to the first few races. And I would imagine that's hopefully quite a relaxed atmosphere to work in right now.
Yeah, for sure. It's exactly what you said. And it's working on the little things like coming in for pit stops, getting used to the procedures, moving the toggles on the wheel, and then doing like things like starts, getting used to that type of procedure, which is really hard in a Formula One car, you know, to do a good start and to do it consistently. It's not easy. And, you know, going through all those, race one laps, making sure the tires are in for qualifying at the right temperature when you push. It's kind of going through all that and having a whole season to do that with a bit more relaxed environment. It gives you more time to be able to learn and not have that added pressure, you know.
I love that radio exchange with Nikita and his engineer in Monaco. When he asked him to change one of the switches, and he said, "Mate, I'm a fucking Monaco."
And then he said,
"Yeah, he's like, I got it now. I know which one it is." It's because it's hard sometimes, and I haven't driven in Monaco, but I imagine it's like, you know, Formula One car from one straight to the other. I mean, it's bumpy as hell. You can't really, you don't have a lot of time. You got like 2, 3, 4 seconds till you reach the braking zone, and like sometimes you have to move a toggle. So you move a toggle so that it sets on the dash, and then when you move it, you then have to. Yeah. There's other toggles on top where you can click through it. So when you move a toggle on the bottom, it shows up on the dash, and then you can adjust that setting through two buttons going like plus or minus, you know, somewhere else on the wheel. And you have to look at the steering wheel to see how many times you click it, you know? So it's not easy. You know,
Even sometimes, okay, I drive the sim at Mercedes, but even sometimes you're driving the sim, you're by yourself. There's no zero pressure. And even when, you know, we've done let's say if we're doing short run simulation or something, and, you know, you're changing diff settings through the lap or engine braking, you know, and all these different toggles that you do, like some of the drivers do 2, 3, 4 times on the qualifying lap. And then that, like you say, they ask you to change like an engine setting or a multifunction setting, like you say, and you have to change the dot, you have to change the toggle, flick the button through the page, and then have to change your engine braking switch, then your diff setting, and then you've got to, you know, do the click the DRS, latch the radio button.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to do sometimes. And when I drive FE on the sim as well, and in FE there's a lot to do, but the car is so much slower that you have more time to do it. But like you say, in F1 you sometimes get like 3 or 4 seconds. In Monaco, you must have like 2 or 3 seconds, yeah, even on the longest straight, to sort of do something.
Yeah, to be able to do it. And after a while, it becomes kind of like muscle memory. You start getting used to it. But when you're still getting used to the car and everything's kind of new to you, then that's when it becomes complicated. If you don't know where it is on the steering wheel and you're having to search, then you're pretty much screwed because you're not going to have time.
Yeah. And for guys like Nikita, I mean, obviously he's a rookie this year and he needs to learn. But you know, if he was in a Mercedes or a McLaren or some Ferrari or something like that, you wouldn't be allowed to have that that learning, let's say. So I guess he's kind of fortunate in a sense that he gets to do his learning in a team that's not got much expectation this year.
I think it's crazy how many switch changes guys do. Because like the one thing we sort of have on the bike is, if you've got the front brake feeling, and if you feel the front brake getting a bit spongy and a bit too far in, you can on your left hand, you can take your left hand off. We've got like a dial we can like turn, which basically extends the lever out, so it moves the bite point further out. So you, when you hit it, it's the same sort of feeling, and that stresses me out. You know, that one change stresses me out more. You know, I'm thinking, oh god, the brake's going spongy, oh, I'm gonna have to change it, where am I gonna do it? But that's one change. You guys do loads of changes through a lap.
Yeah, but the thing you drive falls over if you don't hold on.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. You're on two wheels.
and it falls off a lot with me on it at the minute. So
I'd be more stressed being on two wheels and not having to do any changes and being on four wheels and having to change something every lap. I said, I've never been good on a bike.
You're like this, Jake. I had a little joke with my mate. So I've had a long time off the bike. I had a good year and a half off it with COVID. And the weekend of testing I did before COVID, I had a crash. And that was the last time I rode the bike for a year and a half. And then the first weekend back on it, we had a technical problem, which caused me to crash. So the weekend we've just had was the first time in about 2 years where I haven't crashed a bike on a weekend.
Oh my God.
Well, do you want a well done for that or something?
I do want a well done. Hat on the back.
Can you even crash a road by a cycling bike as well in that time?
No, I ran into the back of a van.
Yeah, that's that.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't fall off it.
Yeah, but that counts.
I just had a big argument with him. And then
that doesn't happen on a motorbike race that often.
No. I avoid vans and bikes, but that's it. Yeah.
So obviously, Pietro, getting back to normal racing, let's say, ones where you can't just fall off. Obviously, this year you're reserve, right? I think that's your title. Mm-hmm. So what does that kind of role entail for you this year? Because I'm kind of, I think, doing I'm reserve driving FE as well. So I think we could have a comparison in that regard about what you do, you know, an F1 reserve versus, let's say, an FE reserve, for example.
Yeah, so, you know, when I first started with Haas, I had a test end of 2018. And then they signed me for 2019. And I was doing testing that year and doing a lot of the simulator work. They had first started 2019, their simulator program with Dallara. So they had to develop that. So in 2019, I was using the sim like a lot. I did like 60 to 70 days on the sim, and we were doing a lot of correlation work. We still weren't to the point where we were using the simulator throughout a race weekend to be able to kind of help with setup, or, you know, to try to get a different opinion or to try something before they try it on track in real life. The simulator wasn't correlated enough to be able to do that. So we were doing it in between races. So we would go on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday after a race weekend, just to kind of correlate from the data we had from the previous race. And I was doing that all of 2019. We started 2020 and then COVID hit. And when COVID happened through 2020, we didn't use the simulator just because of the traveling and stuff. And because the team was, you know, they were like, we got to prioritize other things right now. And this year we've started using it a little bit more than last year, but it hasn't been as much as, you know, 2019. And I think that has something to do also with having a new car and stuff next year. So they don't want to spend or they don't want to like focus so much on the simulator right now when the car is going to be different for the following year. But, you know, the job is using the simulator, doing that correlation work, which I did, and then going to all the race weekends, as many as I can, because I also have my IndyCar program where I'm racing the ovals, and you know, sometimes they clash. So when they don't clash, I go to all the Formula One races.
Yeah, I mean, how do you find over the weekend? Because I mean, even me speaking about my role in FE, obviously I'm privileged and happy to be where I am right now. You know, with a team like Venturi and Mercedes in FE. But obviously, I love driving. I want to drive. You know, I want to be the one racing the car. I'm standing around sometimes and just being involved in the meetings, and that's good. But you know, you want to drive, and sometimes standing around it gets a little bit like, you just wish you were in the car, don't you? I think a little bit. And obviously, you even had that at the end of last year to sort of reminisce to that you had those two races.
Yeah, for sure, man. But you know, it's really tough. Because you're focused and you're grateful for the opportunity and stuff, and you're there working and you're coming to the race weekends, and I'm traveling all over the world going to Formula One races, which a lot of people would, you know, dream to do that. And I do love it, but it's obviously I want to be racing, and I am racing this year, but I'd like to be racing more to get a full-time ride, whether in IndyCar or somewhere else. But it's difficult when you're in the race weekend and, you know, you do your simulator work, then you arrive and you're basically following the team throughout the weekend, going through meetings, like you said. And it's tough because it's not the same. It's not the same as when you're actually driving the car. And you for sure miss that feeling, you know, when the driver's 10 minutes before the session starts go in and they're putting on their helmets and you're putting on your headset. It's like, you know, shit, I wish I was putting on the helmet.
Yeah, I mean,
it's tough.
Sometimes I even feel like, tiny bit of a like I wish I could influence I could, had more influence with the job you do as reserve driver, because like, you know, when you're doing debrief and you're talking to the drivers about stuff, it's a lot of it when you give debriefs as a race driver, you're giving debriefs on feeling, aren't you, of what the car's doing and how it feels. But obviously as reserve driver, you don't have that feeling because you're not driving the car, so there's only a certain amount of things you can comment on, an influence on. There's, you know, the engineers do their job there, the engineers they have a way they talk about setup and things like that, but the driver's job is to report what has happening with the car, and that's generally what a reserve driver would know how to do as well, but without your feeling of actually driving the race car. So sometimes I struggle being at the racetrack thinking like, you know, I want to be involved, I'd like to be involved even more. So I don't know if that's something that you feel.
Yeah, for sure. Because, when you're involved more and you can make a difference, or at least you feel you can make a bigger difference, it's more gratifying, you know. Yeah. The satisfaction is obviously bigger. But at the end, that's the job of the reserve driver. You're kind of there in the shadows, you know, doing all that simulator work, which is a lot of hours. And it's very tiring, too. It's not easy to stay sometimes, you know, 10 hours a day on the simulator. It's tiring work. Sometimes you're kind of hitting against a brick wall trying to get the simulator better and trying to correlate it. But at the end, it's a job, and the job too is, you know, when the time comes for you to get in the car and drive, you have to try to be as ready as possible. But I'm grateful too that I'm also able to race other things. Like last year I was without racing anything. I was supposed to race Super Formula, and then COVID happened, and the Super Formula thing didn't happen. And I was out for the whole season just following the F1 race weekends. And that was really tough. I was like, it was just so tough going from weekend to weekend. And every month, you know, it's clicking, like the months going by. It's like, all right, 2 months without being in a car, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. It's tough, man. It's hard mentally. So I'm grateful this year I've been able to do, you know, I've been racing, and I'm sure like a full-time opportunity is, you know, full-time ride is going to come. I just got to keep pushing.
Yeah, I think all three of us have had periods like that. I mean, I'm actually in that period right now myself. I haven't driven a car since October 2020.
Mm. So how many months has it been since October? It's been November, December.
9 months. It's the longest time I've ever been without driving a car, I think.
That was for me too, yeah.
Yeah, I think if this was like, let's say, 2, 3, 4 years ago, I'd be even more sort of like, not annoyed is the wrong word, but maybe you could say that, impatient than I am now. I think a lot of what I think about where I am right now, not driving right at the moment, is partly because I have enough time, enough stuff to do with simulator and reserve roles and things like that I do in the background, like you say, in the shadows, that, you know, I'm busy and thankfully earning money doing that as well. So I'm not under pressure or anything like that. But also the other reason being with COVID, you know, we've not had any period like this ever in the history of probably motorsport, I guess. Motorsport being around since, what, the 40s or something like that?
After the Second World War,
So, yeah, I don't think any... I can't compare to something that happened. I don't even know what racing was like back then. But, you know, we weren't having time off for a pandemic back then. Mm. And me right now, you know, I've actually had two chances to get into a race car, but couldn't because of quarantine or travel restrictions that only got imposed like 2 or 3 weeks beforehand. Mm. And that's the world we're in right now.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, but I think that's not the only thing, but that's the main reason why I'm sort of quite level-headed about it right now, is hope in the hope that we're not too far away from, you know, things going back to normal. So I guess that's kind of something that
you're out of your control a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, here's a question for you, Jake. Like, because I had a year and a half off of just nothing. How many months did it take? But I got to a point where I didn't really miss it, which is like crazy to think. Really? Like I got to a point where I just sort of accepted fate. Like, and it was like, oh, okay, well, maybe it's not meant to be, or something like that. I got to a point where I thought I was boom, rock bottom. Okay, that's it. It's not meant to be. Have you felt anything like that?
Me not. It's easy to think sometimes, okay, will it get to the level that I know I'm good enough for? Mm. And you know, it's, you know, everyone's only human, so it's natural after 9 months that you know, the level of hope or enthusiasm, whatever you want to call it, sort of jumps up and down. Mm. But I think probably not. I think the reason for me probably why it's not is because I think we have the luxury in car racing that. And the level we are right now with like F1 sims and reserves and Formula E reserves and things like that, there's enough to do to at least take your mind off a bit. Like I'm on the sim 2-3 days a week minimum, either in F1 or FE. You know, I was in Mexico last week and New York next week with FE. And if I wasn't doing that, I would find it really difficult for sure. And I guess that's what you had with motorbikes.
Yeah.
You don't have simulators.
No, we don't. And at that point, I wasn't involved in a program like I am now with Project 109. So I think that also didn't help. But the good thing for me last year is I had my job in the bike shop, you know, working there. So that kind of kept me a bit grounded and a bit focused, because I only dread to think what would have happened or what I would have felt like if I didn't have a job, was stuck at home. You know, couldn't travel, could just train a little bit, but I would have felt terrible.
Yeah, I think that's the hard part about being an athlete or sport or in something like that, is what happens when it gets taken away from you.
Mm.
And it's something that I think in motorsport, at least it seems like, look, if you follow social media, a lot of the community from a fan base point of view sometimes miss like that, how much we do sacrifice. Mm. How much, I mean, especially you, Pietro, I mean, knowing you and Enzo, like, obviously being where you're from and the nationality you are, but where you live and how much you travel, being away from, you know, your girlfriend and family and stuff like that, you do it a lot more, you have to do it a lot more than guys like I do, probably European based. But yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize how much we do sacrifice. And if you get there, and you know, a lot of us think we will, and I definitely think I will eventually, to something like FE or you know, a proper professional contract paid, you know, good amount of money, then you're laughing then. And it's like, well, okay, I live the best life ever. But if it doesn't happen, and it happens to a lot of people, you know, they sacrificed a lot for not a lot in the end, I guess. And that's the risk, not the risk, but that's the life we choose to take. And I'm happy to make that decision. I started late at the age of 16, so I knew exactly what I was going into.
Mm.
Maybe not exactly, but I knew that the risk I was taking. So I think with COVID right now, it's hard for any athlete, I think. And I think I think Petra would say the same, but I'm just at the moment still in the phase of being grateful enough to be busy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but actually, you know, if we speak about COVID, but obviously the benefit of being a reserve driver, I don't want to say with COVID, but, you know, in a world where people can test positive and be in a close contact, get put out of things and can't, you know, have to quarantine and stuff like that.
I think it's the best time ever to be a reserve driver.
It is, really. I've never seen so many reserve drivers in motorsport. And obviously, Pietro, for you last year, that sort of, in a roundabout way, came, well, it wasn't COVID, but being a reserve driver obviously helped you last year.
Yeah, for sure. I know. I mean, it wasn't under the, I didn't do my debut in Formula One in the best circumstances, but, you know, luckily Roman got out of that accident fine, because it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, I spoke to him many times after the accident, and every time he tells me how it was, I mean, it could have gone, you know, the other way, and it would have been a lot worse. You know, he could have died or had a lot worse injuries. So he only, his hand was like really burned, but it could have been his whole body. He could have, when he hit the barrier, could have broken a foot or something, not been able to climb out of the car. So a lot of things could have happened. So I was happy that, you know, he was healthy. That was the most important. And then I got the opportunity to race. And it was like funny, because like when the accident happened, it's like, holy shit, like no one knows what was gonna happen to Roman. Everything looked like it was slow motion. You know, everyone in the team was like, I felt like my heart dropped. I was like, because like when you see a Formula One car hitting a wall and exploding like that,
yeah,
like for the fuel cell is so protected that for it to break through the carbon fiber and cause an explosion, you know, that impact had to be massive.
I mean,
and the only impact you see like that, you know, causes explosion is sometimes on the ovals when Indy cars racing, the car spins around and you hit backwards into the wall and it explodes. But it doesn't really happen that often anymore. And they're doing like 240 miles an hour. So when I saw that car, and as soon as it hit it, it exploded, I was like, holy shit. And everyone in the team was too. And when we saw him run out of the car, that's when everyone, you know, felt a sense of relief. We just didn't know the extent of his injuries, but obviously he got out and ran to the ambulance. So we were assuming he was okay. The only worry was like with the smoke, you know, having breathing the smoke in and stuff. He said at the time when he opened his eyes inside the car, he saw all red, orange, because the fire was around him. And he said he realized something like when he went to breathe, that there was not a lot of oxygen because the fire consumes oxygen.
Yeah.
So then you end up not having a lot to breathe. So imagine like panicking there, you're losing oxygen, you can't really breathe. The fire starting to burn. And he said when he initially went to get out of the car, he hit the barrier, because the car was, you know, it got in pretty deep and the barrier was like right here. It was like in the middle of his head. So when he went to get out, it was hitting his helmet. And then he tried a second time and it started burning his hand. And he was like, you know, I need to get out some way. It's going to burn, but I need to try to get out. He was able to, you know, maneuver himself in and he was able to get out. And I didn't know I was going to drive till, you know, on Sunday, I was there with the team. I didn't ask anything to the team. I wasn't going to be like, oh, yeah, you know, am I going to get to drive? I didn't do anything. I just ate dinner with the team. I went back to the hotel, went to sleep. But obviously on my mind, it was like, shit, I don't know. Will I get to drive? Is Roman, you know, going to come back and drive? You already start thinking about that on that night. But I went to sleep. I woke up in the morning in Bahrain. And I went, you know, for my morning shit normally. No, but seriously,
routine.
I was sitting down in the toilet, and I usually sit down in the toilet, and sometimes I just sit down and I stay there like looking at like motorsport news and stuff, and I get a message from Gunther, and like I see like bing, and it says Gunther, and then I open the message and he's like, Pietro, I need you at the track in about 30 minutes. And I said, all right, no problem. I got up real quick, got changed, and but in my head I was like, why would Gunther be calling me? Like, he wouldn't be calling me to come to the track, you know, to tell me like, oh, you're not gonna get the drive, or like, he would be calling me to talk about the drive, and like, I don't think he would call me to tell me you're not gonna get it. So going to the track, I was like kind of starting to get excited, but I was like, all right, just stay calm, you know, like, let's see what happens. So I arrive at the track, I park the car, I walked to the paddock, and he's sitting down in the table in the hospitality where we eat lunch. Him and this guy called Stuart was the team's communication guy and like the team PR. And he's sitting down there and he has like papers in the desk and stuff. I was like, what the? I was like, I don't know what's going on. Am I getting fired or something? Like, did I do something? You never know, right? And I sit down and you know how Gunther is. He's exactly, you know, obviously Netflix kind of dramatized a little bit, but he's really that person. And he's a really good guy. He's always been very honest and straightforward with me. And he sits down and he looks at me kind of, you know, he goes, are you ready? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I'm ready. Yeah, but I wasn't sure what he was talking about. And he's like, no, you got to say you're born ready. And I said, yeah, for sure, I'm born ready. And he said, good, because you're fucking driving this weekend. And then he brings out the papers and the contract is there. And he's like, I just needed to sign this, but you're driving this weekend. And that's how he told me, you know, that was Monday morning. And I signed and he basically said, what number do you want to use? And I stayed with the number 51, which is the number, the test car number. You know, the number that they had for the test cars when I did all my testing, it was that number. And I said, you know, I'm being promoted to race. I'm going to keep the number as well. And the good thing that it was that I had the whole week to kind of prepare for the race weekend, you know, I had the whole Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, to get, you know, my head in sync with the team and kind of with what I was going to have to do. And the tough thing was, is it had been 9 months since I hadn't driven anything and the year since I hadn't driven the F1 car. So imagine,
that is a joke.
Dude. Yeah. So like, obviously in your head, obviously I was confident. Like, I know I can do the job without a doubt, but I've never been this long without driving a race car. The most I've ever been without driving a race car was like maximum, like three and a half months, you know, over the winter. And then you have, when that happens, you have testing and stuff, preseason testing to get in sync and in the rhythm. So I was thinking like, obviously it go through my head. I was like, all right, I'm going to jump in FP1 straight into an official practice already with the longest by over three times that I haven't been in a race car. I haven't been in a race car in 9 months and I haven't driven in the F1 car in about over a year. And I was like, all right, this isn't going to be, it's not going to be easy. No. But I just want to tell you, like, it comes back so quick, Jake. Like, if you think like, oh, it's going to be a long time and you think you're going to be like, shit, am I going to lose my, you know, my skills or something? It comes back and it comes back really fast. Obviously, like the racecraft stuff, you're going to be a little bit rusty, a little bit initially. But I remember first time going out in FP1, like just getting used to the speeds. And the one thing that caught me off guard is like the vibrations of the car, which you usually get, it becomes natural. You don't even feel it when you're driving often. But when you're out for a long time, when you're going through the straights, like your body feels weird. It's almost like humming with the, you know, with all the vibrations and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like a weird feeling. And, you know, I did an out lap and I came in. And when I came in, I said, all right, now we're going to go for an actual run. And I did the run and, you know, I got up to speed really quick and I felt really comfortable with the car off the bat. And now I was really happy about that because obviously I was thinking, you know, 9 months without driving a car, how quick am I going to be able to adapt to it? Mm-hmm. But it came back super, super quick. Physically, I was destroyed the day after.
Yep.
I was destroyed. I had a physio at the time who was the team's physio. And her name was Faith. She's a English girl. And she does like she does physio work for the team and the mechanics. And because I didn't have a physio there, the team put her to work with me, but she had never worked with a driver before. And it was her first, you know, weekend working with a driver in a Formula One race or with any driver. And it was funny because, like, you know, after Friday, she was helping me out with like getting, you know, making sure my muscles recover. Because honestly, like under braking, which was the worst thing, especially at that track that we were doing the short version in Bahrain, your neck was getting destroyed. Like at points, you can't hold your neck back. Under braking, it's not really the corners, because the corners you can put pads on the side that you know to hold your helmet, but it's under braking where your head just there's nothing to hold it. So what I did is she was obviously taping my neck and stuff, and but I asked Belle, you know, the foam under the helmet.
I think the
normal foam when you put on a helmet.
Yeah.
I asked them to get me like a super thick one, so I had some extra support. So my head wouldn't go down because, dude, honestly, it wasn't allowed to put a foam on my belt because I was going to put some stiff ass foam to keep my head up. Yeah. But I was only able to put it on the helmet. And it was like, if you look at some pictures on my helmet, there's like a bit of a lump of the red foam. And it was because it was helping me hold my head up. But yeah, so like the first race weekend, it was, you know, it was an amazing experience. And obviously I was getting used to the schedule and stuff. And on Sunday morning before the race was at night, I went to the gym with the physio, just to get warmed up and stuff. And I got a call from Gunther and he said, you know, Pietro, take this weekend. I just want to call you and let you know, take this race step by step, do as many miles as you can. There's no pressure at all. You've been doing a great job. And you're going to be racing next weekend. So he told me that. Yeah. And that was a great thing because I wasn't sure if I was going to race in Abu Dhabi or not, which was the next, you know, the last race. So I was going in like, maybe the team's trying to see, you know, the job I can do before telling me, or maybe Roman is going to, you know, get in the car. But he told me before the race started, he's like, yeah, you're going to be racing next weekend. So that was a huge sense of relief as well. It's like, I have another race weekend, you know?
That's the best thing that I think he could have probably said to you that morning.
Yeah, because you never know, mate, because in your head, you're probably thinking, oh, this might be my only shot to race in Formula One. But then I already went into the race with, like, you know, the easy mind, like, I'm racing another weekend after this one. So that was really good. And I remember Faith was the name of the physio. She was helping me with all the schedule stuff, right? Because when you go to the grid, the car goes out of the garage, the installation lap, you park the car in the grid, and you get out of the car. There's a bunch of ceremonies that go through it. And she was the one kind of taking me through it. And it was funny because at a certain point, she was a little bit lost. You know, she was doing a great job, but she was a bit lost of like when I had to go to do the national anthem and stuff. And she was a little bit nervous. And I could tell she was getting really flustered because she sent me to, we went to go do the national anthem and it wasn't there. We had to go somewhere else. And we're losing the timing of it. And her name's Faith. And she was more nervous than me. And I was telling her, I said, Faith, just have a little bit of faith. Everything's going to work out.
Brilliant.
It was so funny because it was a cool experience for both of us. Because then going to Abu Dhabi, obviously I had more experience and she had more experience as well. So it was really cool. And I was really happy with the performance. Like, you know, in Bahrain, the team asked me to give a tow to Kevin in qualifying because they had to replace a battery in my car. So I was going to have a grid penalty anyways. So I was going to start last. So they asked me to give a tow there to try to get him in a Q2. So we did that. And, you know, we had a good race in Bahrain, but in Abu Dhabi, it was like, I was going to, you know, have the full go at qualifying and the race and stuff. And I remember first set of tires, you know, with Kevin, I was matched his time. I was within half a tenth of his time. On the second set, again, within half a tenth, you basically ran similar time. On the third set of tires, he improved like by two and a half tenths. And I couldn't do my lap because Latifi spun in front of me, caused a yellow flag, and I couldn't push in sector one. But then in the race, you know, had a good start, felt good in the car. The performance was good. I was able to pass Kevin. I was able to catch some of the Williams cars, and we had to do extra pit stops because it was similar to what happened with George this weekend with there's like a compressor system where you have to fill it up. It's called the ALS. And that compressor was leaking air for me. So I had to do extra stops to kind of refill it and stuff, which ruined our race result. But it was an amazing experience. And the last thing, the coolest thing for me was like in Abu Dhabi, I was a lot calmer. Faith, you know, was good with her schedule and stuff. So we were able to arrive on things with time. And when I parked the car in the starting grid, I got out and I walked up to do the national anthem. You know, you walk up and there's like a little board with your name, and it's like there's a Brazilian flag and then my name, Fittipaldi, and number 51. That's where you're supposed to stand. So I go there, I'm standing there, and there's like the prince of whatever, the UAE there, and they start singing the national anthem. Like I start standing and like I look to my left and it's like Kimi Raikkonen. And then across him is like Lewis Hamilton. And then to my right is Vettel. And like, and I was like, I was thinking about his, fuck, you know, like I used to watch these guys race and I'm here racing. And that for me was like an amazing feeling. And then walking back to the grid, like, you know, passing the Mercedes, the Ferrari, and like, it was just an amazing feeling to be there racing. Because you know how hard it is to make it to Formula One. It's so difficult nowadays. There's only 20 seats and it's to get the chance is, you know, it's very hard. And I was super happy about that.
I was just enjoying listening to you there for 10 minutes. That was that was brilliant.
That's the whole story. That's how it was. That's how I felt and how everything went. You know, it was a great experience for me.
I think the first thing, like, we're all fans, aren't we?
For sure.
Like, we all love it and we all fans. And like, oh man, I could only imagine just like that feeling of looking right and looking left and thinking, shit. you know,
I think like we legends. Obviously, me and Pietro dream against Formula One. You, Alex, dream against MotoGP. But really, it's the same thing in terms of, you know, dreaming. And that was just really nice, honestly, mate. Just to listen to you sort of, reel off that experience. How I could see in your face, obviously, it's and the then even in your voice, if people are listening, just like, you know, how strong that feeling and emotion still is.
thanks, man.
But yeah, I think you did a really good job. Yeah. I mean, I think it's stating the obvious. It was that obvious that you did a good job. But yeah, I mean, I remember like you say in qualifying in Abu Dhabi, following it, he's nearly out qualifying, Kevin.
Kevin's a great guy. And he helped me throughout the whole race weekends and stuff. And he taught me a lot of things. But obviously I was thinking that it's super important for me if I can like go there and like really show what I can do on the biggest stage. Without, you know, being a year off of racing and stuff. And I was so pissed when like Nicholas spun in front of me and I couldn't do my lap because it was qualifying where like at the last set, it was sunsetting. So it gets a lot cooler, the track. So obviously, you know, you're going to go quicker. And Kevin only went like 2.5 tenths quicker. So I was like, man, I'm sure I can go quicker. And I was like, but you know, at the end I was happy with the opportunity and with the job I did. But you know how it is as a racing driver. You're like, if I could have just had that last shot there. But
always want more, don't we?
I remember going to the FE rookie test in February last year. And I was in it with Mercedes and I was pretty much quickest the whole morning and top three the whole morning and afternoon. And then in the very last like 10 minutes, because you're only allowed a certain amount of laps on pool power in the test day, and on the very last sort of 5 minutes, everyone went out to do their laps in the last 5 minutes, like cooling temperatures, most rubber on the track, and I dropped a seventh basically because we'd done them straight after lunch in boiling hot conditions, but it was part of our test program, and everyone's telling me in the team like, oh, obviously how much of a good job you did, and everyone's messaging me going, oh, you know, how you did, you know, that looked so good for you, but it's like deep down you're like, yes, but I know how it works. And perception wise, I'm seventh and not fastest, which is
I know, but you know, I think a lot of that sometimes comes in our head and it's not really, you know, I think it's us being a little greedy sometimes because things could have gone a lot worse. Maybe you would have gone there at the end and fucking cool track and stuff. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to really give it the beans now. And you send the car straight in the wall. And then, you know what I mean? So, because I'm every driver's like that. You always want more. And then sometimes it's trying to control your ego a little bit and like understand, you know, you can't be too greedy at all times, you know, understand that, you know, you did a good job and the team knows that, but for sure you want to be up there on the board, whether it'll make a difference or not, I don't know, but you know, it's feeling.
It's like why I think what Gunter told you that Sunday morning was so important to say that you're racing next week, because We've all been there, and you know, you go and do, you get a chance to do a test or to do a race or whatever it is to do with a big team in a big championship with a, in a fast car, whatever it is, and it's always the same. Like I've done DTM tests, the same with everyone at Formula E tests, where they tell you the same thing, which is, you know, you don't need, just don't crash it, basically. Don't, you don't need to, you know, we just test, just get through the program. But in your mind, you're like, well, I need to do a good job, because I want to show you that I'm ready, like I can do that. And in your case, it would have been like, if he hadn't told you that on Sunday morning, you might have started to over push to be like, you know, I need to do a good job. I need to find every single, you know, wrangle every single tenth out of the car. I need to be following Kevin, you know, because I want to be racing next year. I need to show I'm going to be, and I'm not going to get this chance to show this again. So you risk making the mistake to the reward of looking good. But if somebody tells you, you're going to, don't worry, you got another chance next week. That just, you know, you can get the experience. You can, like you say, you can learn, find out all the silly things about the car before you go and make yourself look silly by putting it in the wall.
Because it's really easy to go from hero to zero. And you can be there thinking, let me just squeeze another 10th out and destroy the car, cost $500,000 damage. And then you go to zero really quick. It's always a fine line. It's always playing with that.
But it is hard though, isn't it? Because if you don't push, or if you don't try and do a good job, let's say, and you just drive at 95%, well, then next time there's a seat available, an opportunity available, the team probably might look the other way because they'll reference in their driver search. They'll go, well, we did have, you know, Pietro or Jake in the test and he was, you know, it was all right, but he was a bit safe. Can't be sure. And they might, you just go for somebody else or let's say another team definitely wouldn't look, you know, because they looked at the test and didn't see anything special. So it's a hard one. Because you need to try and show what you can do. But like you say, you cannot make yourself look like an idiot. But because we're coming towards it, I can't believe how quickly this has gone, mate, to be honest.
Again.
I just enjoy listening to you. But I just want to quickly touch on the fact that obviously last month you did your Indy 500 debut.
Yeah.
So how, like, obviously it's not even comparable. I'm not even going to ask you the question actually about how comparable it is to F1 because it's just the almost, apart from having two wheels like Alex, it's probably the complete opposite. But how was that experience like? Obviously, I think you did a good job as well, but how was that?
Yeah, it was amazing. To drive on an oval, like the Formula One car is the best car to drive in the world, like the most enjoyable car to drive because the car is stuck to the ground. When you put new tires and stuff, I mean, you can do basically whatever you want with the car. On an oval, the driving a race car in an oval, like an Indy car, that's by far what will give you the most adrenaline. Like the scent, dude, by far. Like the Formula One car, the car's stuck. I mean, it's amazing. It's like a rocket ship. It has a performance of like, it's like just incredible all around. But the sense of speed and the sense of adrenaline driving an oval on an Indy car and an oval on a super speedway, it by far surpasses anything I've ever done. And I've driven like a lot of different cars. When you're going there averaging like 230 miles an hour, for example, qualifying for four laps, you trim the car, it's crazy. And like everything they do, it's like it starts hyping up the event. So you have 5 days of testing before qualifying, knowing that there's 35 cars there and only 33 cars are going to qualify. And like, you usually know you're pretty safe, but you never know, dude. If you go like Will Power this year, Indy 500 winner, almost didn't qualify because sometimes it's the Indianapolis, it's a track where everything is so sensitive that little things you do on the car make a big difference. And you can have just one setback that'll put you so back and you might not even qualify for the race. My grandfather with Penske, and it was him and Alan Sir Jr. I forgot what year it was, but they didn't qualify for the race. And they were like in a Penske car. They had won the previous year, were winning races that year, and they didn't qualify. So you always have that in the back of your mind. And like the adrenaline of just driving that car is crazy, especially like in qualifying, because they give you extra horsepower, extra boost. And it's a four lap average. So you have to go out of the pits and basically you want to hold it wide open for four laps. And that speed is insane. And again, you know, doing the race, and they had like 200,000 people there. The grandstands were full. So you're there on the grid. I started 13th. I was fastest rookie in qualifying, you know, starting fifth row was pretty good. And you're there standing, they do the national anthem, you know, they shoot the guns, how they do in the US, like do all the show. And you're standing there and you're like 200,000 people. Bro. It's like you're standing in the freaking finals of a World Cup. It's like the stadium is like packed. And then they do parade laps with the car. So you go three wide because the start is three wide and you go super slow. You're supposed to wave at the fans. I didn't wave because like, don't know, I kept two wheels and two hands on the wheel. Yeah. But you're going really slow and like you see everybody and it's an insane feeling. For me, I think that race, it'll be the most satisfying race to win compared to all the other races. Cause you're there for so long. The risk is so high. Mentally, it's so taxing as well. You're so tired by the end of it. Like to win a race like that is like, for me, would be the, by far, like the greatest feeling in the world. And I was really happy to be there racing and supposed to race in 2018. I was going to do it. And then I had that accident in Spa, which inhibited me from doing it. So then I got another chance this year. So I was really happy and we were doing really well, but the strategy didn't work out. It's a long story, but we're definitely looking like we're going to have like a top 12 finish and just race didn't go our way in terms of strategy. Same with my teammate and a couple other cars. So
how is it like, because when you can't get an impression for it on TV, like how it is to drive the car. I mean, even somebody who's okay, I haven't never driven an oval, but driven race, plenty of race cars. And, you know, someone like me, I still cannot get an impression for how on edge the car is, let's say, especially on a quali lap, because it looks like you're just driving around left, like you're just going easy and the speed, you look at the end of the lap and the speed comes up 230 or whatever on the, but in the car, everyone always says, and I completely can appreciate that it's true, but just sort of explain it, how on edge are they to drive, like especially on a quali lap?
No, it's on edge and you're pushing yourself as well, like mentally every time you get in the car, because like it's one simple mistake and you hit the wall and you're hitting the wall really hard. And like, once you have a crash there, like it really sets you back. And like the chance of you getting injured is pretty high and stuff. It's like getting punched by Mike Tyson. Like when you hit the wall, like 230, 240, it's a massive impact. So like when you're doing those speeds and you're skimming the wall and stuff, there's always that intimidation factor. So mentally it's taxing, but the car is, you know, they trim it for qualifying that you could just barely do it flat out for four laps. And everyone is on the limit because, you know, you're trying to qualify well, but as well, you don't want to be risking being bumped out of the race. So you go out and the cars in qualifying are lined up one by one. And, you know, one car goes out and then the other car goes out. And that already builds that adrenaline. And the car really is on the limit. And if the wind changes a little bit, like you get a gust of wind in the middle of the corner, like the car will push towards the wall and you'll end up having to lift or hit the wall. So you always have that sense of like, you don't know what you're going to get. But when you go out for qualifying, knowing you have literally one shot to be able to qualify for the race, if you go out there and you lift and stuff, like you're, you know, you skim the wall, you might be out of the race, like all that, you know, that work you did to be there, it's all gone. So you go out there with the head is like, as soon as I leave the pits, I will not lift anymore until I'm done with qualifying. And you go out with that mentality, but like you go into the corner and the speeds, when you go for qualifying, they boost the pressure more. So the engine's a lot more powerful. So you're arriving at like 240 miles an hour, where initially in practice, you're arriving at like 220 into the corner. So you're arriving like 20 miles an hour quicker. And you have a day before qualifying to practice this, where they call it Fast Friday. So they bump it up to simulate qualifying. But you go in there and the car's so quick, man. And like you just have, you turn in, you have to be smooth. And the thing is, the first lap, it's fine. The second lap, the car starts washing out a little bit. The third lap, it starts washing out more. Then you start working on your tools because you got the front bar, you got the rear bar, and you got the weight jacker. So you start moving it lap to lap to adjust the balance. And then by the fourth lap, you're just there, like, just holding it. And, like, you're really getting close to hitting the wall. And it's hard to explain the feeling, but it's like an adrenaline. Like, if you're there testing on an oval by yourself, by the end of the day, even if the test wasn't good, like, you're kind of satisfied because it's like, another day. Yeah, like, oh, what a day.
Yeah. Oh,
It's like that. It's a crazy thing, and I don't get that in any other type of racing, at least in my experience.
Even that F1 race.
No, it's like the adrenaline and that feeling of like, one day if you drive an oval and you do an IndyCar in it, you'll understand. Like, it's like that feeling of like, wow, I'm going so quick.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. I must have said this on another episode. I think part of it is, what I'm about to say is part of it is because in Europe we don't have any ovals really. It's just not part of the, you know, what you learn to do. So I've never experienced it, never come close to experience, never been to even an oval track apart from Rockingham, but that doesn't count. And I guess I haven't had the appreciation for it yet. So I don't have the desire to do it, yeah, really, because I suppose I don't know how it feels. I feel like I get more than enough enjoyment out of driving a Formula car on a proper, you know, normal circuit than I could in that, but
yeah,
I'm probably wrong.
But some people enjoy it, some people don't. Some people go out there and they really don't like the ovals.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you have a bad car, especially racing, like, it's even harder. Doing qualifying and trimming the car is one thing, but then when you go out in the race and there's a lot of turbulence, that's even harder. And that's when it starts getting really sketchy and you start putting yourself in kind of, you know, scary situations. But when the car is bad, for example, it's like the worst time of your life. You just want the race to finish because you're there struggling and you're risking so much. And you're like, this is just terrible. Like, I just want to stop and just let's go to the next race already. When the car is good, it's a great feeling. And when you win in an oval, it's great because it's like it's very satisfying. But some people just plain out don't like oval racing. I really enjoy it. I've always liked it. But for sure, there's times where I'm like, I'd rather be in the garage now than driving the car out here.
maybe one day I'll get to I'll experience it and we can have another podcast and just talk about the experience of it. But yeah, mate, we pretty much got to our hour there. But I just want to finish on one question, because you just got me thinking about it now, explaining it, because you seem so passionate about both. Which would you choose? If you could drive, you know, for the rest of your career, would you do F1 or IndyCar? I think I know that.
Oh, man, that's a tough question.
Yeah.
That's very tough. I would say I'd start with Formula One and then I'd go to IndyCar.
Yeah.
But I it's hard to choose one because I would like to be successful in both and win in both, you know.
Yeah.
Like, imagine one day you go and you win F1 race and then you win the Indy 500. You know, to win the Indy 500 is also something massive. So, it's hard to choose between one or the other.
Yeah. Fair enough, mate. I think we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there, mate. Thanks for coming on.
Sorry really it took so long. It's like it's hard to find the time. I knew this week, mate, I was going to be here and stuff, but I appreciate it. It was really fun, man. Thank you.
Nah, mate, you don't need to apologize, honestly. Coming from somebody who knows how busy it can get, I really don't need to apologize to me or even Alex. We know how busy everyone gets in motorsport. Just thank you for making the time. And I really, really enjoyed that, mate. Like even just like I said, just listening to you was really interesting, especially about that F1 experience. But thank you everyone for coming to join us again on the HYM podcast. We really appreciate all the support we're getting at the moment. Hopefully we'll continue to take off as we're going along. Please leave a like, subscribe, comment, go and follow Pietro on Instagram. I think it's pfitty, right? Your Instagram P-Fitty. Handle. P50, yeah, that sounds like a DJ name or something, or a rapper's name. I like it. To be honest, everyone's listening probably follows you already, but just in case. Thank you guys, and feel free and make sure to join in next week for another episode on the HYM podcast. Thank you for joining.
Cheers, thank guys. You guys. I appreciate it.